Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the August 11th, 2023 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week is set in front of the United States Capitol. Senator Dianne Feinstein is sitting in a wheelchair. President Joe Biden and Senator Mitch McConnell are sitting in rocking chairs. They've both got little blankets draped across their laps. The three of them are talking and laughing. There's a nurse taking Senator McConnell's blood pressure. And the headline is, Refusing to Retire, Why the U.S. is Governed by a Gerontocracy. And that is going to be our controversy of the week, but we'll start with the first main story. Trump indicted for conspiring to overturn election. What happened? A grand jury indicted Donald Trump this week on multiple charges connected to his efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Marking the third time in 5 months, the former president has been hit with criminal charges even as he mounts another run for the White House. In a 45-page indictment filed in Washington, D.C., special counsel Jack Smith charged Trump with four felony counts for his efforts to overturn the will of voters and stay in power. Trump's refusal to accept election results culminated on January 6, 2021, in an unprecedented assault on the seat of American democracy, Smith said, one that was fueled by lies. The indictment alleges that Trump engaged in several conspiracies to promote claims of voter fraud he knew were false, tried to threaten and intimidate officials in battleground states to support his efforts, and repeatedly pressured Vice President Mike Pence to block Joe Biden's certification, telling him, "You're too honest," when he said he did not have that power. Each of these conspiracies, said the indictment, targeted a bedrock function of the United States federal government, the nation's process of collecting, counting, and certifying the results of the presidential election. The indictment charges only Trump with crimes, but describes six unnamed co-conspirators who aided his bid to overturn the election, including creating a slate of false electors from several swing states. Those co-conspirators reportedly include former Trump lawyers Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell, and then Justice Department official Jeffrey Clark. Smith said the investigation is continuing. Trump called the charges fake and compared the Biden administration to Nazi Germany. He has now been charged with 78 counts in three criminal indictments, including charges of unlawfully retaining classified documents and obstructing efforts to retrieve them, and falsifying business records to cover up hush money payments to a porn star before the 2016 election. A fourth indictment is expected soon from prosecutors in Fulton County, Georgia, connected to Trump's efforts to pressure Georgia officials to overturn the 2020 election results. What the editorial said. Smith's indictment is a watershed moment for the country, said the Boston Globe. The case will undoubtedly touch off a political maelstrom. But with overwhelming evidence that a sitting president tried to carry out a coup, the greater risk to our democracy would have been for prosecutors to do nothing. This indictment shouldn't stand, said National Review. We have repeatedly condemned Trump's appalling actions following the 2020 election, but President Biden's Justice Department is using flimsy legal theories to try to criminalize protected speech of a political opponent. Using mendacious rhetoric to stay in office is damnable, but it's not a crime. And to make his charges stick, Smith will have to prove Trump hadn't actually convinced himself that the election was stolen from him. Good luck with that. what the columnist said. This is the big one, said Richard L. Hasten in Slate. Smith's new charges are by far the most serious ones facing Donald Trump, and it's perhaps the most important indictment ever handed down to safeguard American democracy and the rule of law. Trump's corrupt intent was clear. Top aides repeatedly told him that the election was not stolen, and there was no evidence for his outrageous claims of ballot tampering. Nonetheless, he relentlessly pressured state legislators, state election officials, Department of Justice officials, and his own vice president to declare him the victor of an election he clearly lost. The indictment includes a shocking new detail, said Matt Steeb in New York Magazine, when then-Deputy House Counsel Patrick Philbin told Clark that if Trump refused to leave office, there would be riots in every major city. Clark responded, "Well, that's why there's an Insurrection Act," suggesting Trump would order the military to use force against citizens in the streets of America. The case is no slam dunk, said David French in the New York Times. Much of it depends on establishing Trump's state of mind and proving beyond a reasonable doubt that Trump knew he lost. That could prove tricky, said Jim Garrity in National Review. Trump very often makes claims that aren't true and gives every impression of actually believing them. Being delusional is not a crime. In coming months, American democracy will face a crucial test, said David Remnick in The New Yorker. Are voters willing to overlook an effort to subvert democracy and return the chief conspirator to power? Polls show multiple indictments haven't dissuaded a large portion of the electorate from standing by their hero, who stands a very real chance of returning to the White House in 2024. Both in the courts and at the ballot box, the nation is headed for a great reckoning. And the controversy of the week, the gerontocracy. Why do octogenarians run Washington? Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell was fielding questions from reporters at a typical Washington press conference last week when the 81-year-old froze mid-sentence. For 20 awkward and alarming seconds, McConnell stared glassy-eyed into the middle distance, clearly unable to speak. Fellow Republicans exchanged panicked looks, and Senator Joni Ernst, Republican from Iowa, crossed herself before a colleague led McConnell away by his arm. Though McConnell seemed to recover later in the day, his episode has revived uncomfortable questions about the age and frailty of lawmakers in Washington, said Lauren Fedor in the Financial Times. McConnell, a survivor of childhood polio, reportedly has fallen multiple times and suffered a concussion and broken ribs in a fall in March. Aides push Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat from California, around the Capitol in a wheelchair and shield her from the press. She appears to be strikingly frail and to be struggling with cognitive problems. Witnessing our gerontocracy's senior moments, said Charlie Sykes in the Bulwark, one can't help but think about President Biden, who at 80 walks with arthritic stiffness, has tripped multiple times, and sometimes makes odd comments that leave even his aides scratching their heads. Imagine if the commander-in-chief had an episode like McConnell's. Our politics would be upended in the blink of an eye. It feels like American politics has suddenly gone from ruling class to drooling class, said Matt Lewis in the Daily Beast. The average senator is 65 years old, making this the oldest Senate in history. At 89, Republican Charles Grassley of Iowa was recently reelected to a six-year term. Former President Trump loves to mock Biden's age, but he's not far behind at 77. Yes, the marvels of modernity have allowed more of us to work productively into an advanced age. But after 75, and especially after 80, a decline is inevitable. Mother Nature always wins. Always. Perhaps we need age limits for political seats, said Kirsten Fleming in the New York Post. If your grandma were as confused and frail as these ancient officials often seem to be, you'd take away her keys and sell her Buick to the teenage neighbor. Blame the voters for reelecting the same senior citizens over and over, said Zachary B. Wolf in CNN.com. McConnell's office says he will serve as GOP leader through his term, which ends in 2027. If he seeks another term, does anyone think dark red Kentucky wouldn't reelect him? After all, the most powerful force in American politics is incumbency. In the 2022 midterms, every incumbent senator on the ballot won. Millennials complain about baby boomers clinging to power, but in recent presidential primaries, young progressives cast their vote for Bernie Sanders, now 81, and Elizabeth Warren, 74. Millennials are America's largest generation by population, but they're one of the smallest groups that make up Congress. Blame also the politicians who suffer from Potomac fever, said Kathleen Parker in the Washington Post. In Washington, it's easy to become addicted to the intoxicating thrill of power, privilege, and relevance. After a decade or two or three, people convince themselves they're indispensable and can't imagine returning to life as a private citizen. By refusing to leave the stage in a rapidly changing world, octogenarian politicians are depriving the country of fresh insights and representation, and they need to get out of the way. There's no shame in recognizing when one's job is done. Here's our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for inclusion after President Biden publicly acknowledged for the first time that he has 7 grandchildren, including Hunter's out-of-wedlock daughter, Navy, 4. Jill and I only want what is best for all of our grandchildren, including Navy, said Biden. It was a good week for Swifties, who did so much singing, dancing, and jumping up and down at a Taylor Swift Eras concert in Seattle that they caused seismologists to register a 2.3 Swift quake. It was a good week for downtime after the Hollywood actor's strike reportedly has led to a boomlet in plastic surgery. Since the strike may last months, said Beverly Hills plastic surgeon Ben Talai. Many A-list and B-list actors are running in to do it. But it was a bad week for marking the spot after San Francisco authorities forced Elon Musk to remove a new X sign from the former Twitter building because neighboring residents complained the flashing strobe lights were so bright that it lit up their apartments. It was a bad week for resets after GOP presidential candidate Ron DeSantis offered to have a beer with New Hampshire primary voters for $50, then cut the price to $1, and only 30 people showed up. DeSantis insisted we're making big, big progress in connecting with voters. It's a bad week for typos after police officers in Texas pulled over and pointed guns at an Arkansas family, including a 6-year-old, driving to a youth basketball tournament. One cop had typed AZ instead of AR into a license plate search and concluded their car was stolen. It looks like we made a mistake, an officer told the weeping family. And here's a short and other news piece. Signs of summer COVID wave as hospitalizations rise. The U.S. appears to be experiencing a summer COVID spike, with the Centers for Disease Control reporting that weekly hospitalizations have climbed 12% to 8,035. Cases appear to be climbing fastest in the Southeast, where searing heat has led many people to shelter in air-conditioned spaces, and slowest in the Midwest. After roughly 6-7 months of steady declines, things are starting to tick back up again, said CDC COVID incident manager Dr. Brendan Jackson. Older people account for most hospitalizations, but deaths have continued to fall, hitting their lowest levels on record. The FDA is expected to approve an updated vaccine in September to boost immunity and curb a potential winter COVID wave. The briefing this week is titled, The Fight for Equal Pay. The Women's World Cup is the largest women's tournament ever, but the athletes are still fighting to share in its success. How popular is women's soccer? It's booming. This month's tournament, hosted by Australia and New Zealand, will have an audience of nearly 2 billion people. More than 1.5 million tickets sold, and an expanded field of 32 teams. The popularity of women's soccer has been rising steeply, with revenue growing globally from merchandising, sponsorship, and broadcast deals. Players are advocating for higher pay, but overall revenue still trails that of men's soccer, except in the U.S. The four-time World Cup-winning women's team has eclipsed the mediocre men's team in visibility and revenue, and its players fought a public battle for equal pay during the 2019 World Cup. Star player Megan Rapinoe, playing in her last World Cup, said the team refused to accept anything other than what we felt like we deserved. Did they succeed? Yes. After 6 years of negotiations and a lawsuit alleging gender discrimination, the U.S. Women's National Team Players Association and the U.S. Soccer Federation signed a collective bargaining agreement last year. Women are now paid at the same rate as men for tournament wins and game appearances. The men and women will also pool the prize money from both the men's and women's World Cups and divide it at 45% each, with a 10% cut for the Federation. It's an attempt to rectify the disparity in prize money that FIFA doles out for the two events, $440 million for the men last year, compared with $110 million, a new high for the women this summer. FIFA is aiming to achieve equal prize money during the next World Cup cycle in 2026 and 2027. This is a truly historic moment, said U.S. Soccer President Cindy Parlow Cohn. These agreements have changed the game forever here in the United States and had the potential to change the game around the world. How does the player pay work? Players earn most of their income from match fees of $8,000 per game, with a $10,000 bonus if the team wins. With players participating in 18 to 24 matches a year, they can earn about $450,000 in annual payments from U.S. Soccer. Most national team members also play for a club team in the National Women's Soccer League, where the minimum salary increased from $22,000 to $35,000 last year. Women have agreed to be paid similarly to men, with those called up to the national team getting paid per match rather than relying on a base salary. Rapinoe said the players were very aware that their battle for equality would have larger resonance for women on other teams and in all walks of life. What we're most proud of, Rapinoe said, is that it's been something that people can see themselves in and gain confidence from. How profitable is the sport? The National Women's Soccer League witnessed a 20% increase in season ticket holders this year. But in the U.S., women's games were generating more revenue than men's as far back as 2016, when the women brought in $1.9 million more than the men. From 2016 to 2018, they brought in about $50.8 million versus the men's $49.4 million. Those figures provided the U.S. women with a solid argument for their right to equal earnings. But the same is not true for women's soccer in most other countries, where soccer is the primary sport and the men's teams generate far more revenue. In order to pay equally, the broadcasting figures or sponsorship figures have to tally, said England men's team manager Gareth Southgate. It's probably an area that people don't want to speak about, but there is an economic reality to that. How well are women paid elsewhere? The women's teams in Brazil, New Zealand, Australia, and England have signed equal pay agreements with their federations. But a new report from the Global Players Union found that 29% of players in this World Cup hadn't been paid anything for playing in qualifying tournaments, and two-thirds of the athletes had to use vacation days or take unpaid leave from another job to participate in those tournaments. The Nigerian team threatened to boycott this World Cup over a fight with its federation about withheld payments, while the reigning Olympic champion Canadian team is locked in a years-long battle over equal pay. This fight is going on even as a 2022 FIFA survey of nearly 300 women's soccer clubs found that commercial revenue had grown 33% in 1 year and broadcast revenue rose by 22%. Sarah Behrman, FIFA's chief women's football officer, said the growth potential of the sport is enormous. It's just getting those people that are involved, particularly in the highest levels of our game all around the world, to see and understand the opportunity that sits in front of them, she said. Time for a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with two from the U.S. First up, when liberals disagree with liberal dogma. If I disagree with my liberal tribe, said Kat Rosenfield, does that make me a conservative? I've been wondering about this since looking into the illustrated novel Gender Queer, which has been described as the most banned book in the country. The book, written and drawn by non-binary author Maya Kobabi, follows the journey of a trans teen who is disgusted by their girl body and contains graphic illustrations of oral sex, masturbation, and a strap-on penis. Liberals have praised the book as groundbreaking and essential, while conservatives have denounced it as pornographic. My own reaction is that the book is best reserved for adult readers, not middle school libraries. But in our polarized political culture, those who stray from the maximally permissive views on any culture war issue can suddenly find themselves non-consensually categorized as far-right fascist of their dangerous enablers. Maybe that's why nearly 40% of Americans now identify themselves as social conservatives, the strongest showing for conservatives in more than 10 years. If left-leaning voters feel they cannot deviate from radical progressive ideas about gender and sexuality, don't be surprised if they defect or don't vote. This is how you lose elections. Yes, Congress can regulate the Supremes. There he goes again, said Ruth Marcus. Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito has once again used the friendly platform of the Wall Street Journal opinion section to punch back at critics who are calling on Congress to set clear, enforceable ethics rules for the court's justices. After Alito and Justice Clarence Thomas were caught failing to report lavish vacations and gifts from politically active billionaire conservatives. No provision in the Constitution, Alito told the Journal, gives Congress the authority to regulate the Supreme Court, period. His arrogant claim is not only unseemly and unsettling, it's flatly wrong. Under the Constitution, Congress sets the size of the court, which has changed many times, and determines its budget and staffing. By law, Congress requires all federal judges, including Supreme Court justices, to recuse themselves from cases in which their impartiality might reasonably be questioned, and requires them to file financial disclosure forms and disclose stock transactions. Is that unconstitutional? Yes, the Constitution calls for the separation of powers, but it also gives the three branches of government authority to check the powers, the other's power. Supreme Court justices are not omnipotent demigods, no matter what Alito may wish. This column comes from Jamaica. The high price of cheap aluminum. Bauxite has proved to be Jamaica's curse, said Esther Figueroa. This island nation has North America's largest reserve of bauxite, the main ingredient in aluminum. And for decades, we've allowed mining companies to bulldoze our rolling hills to make open pit mines that leave ugly red scars in the land. This has had devastating consequences for our environment, decimating forests, polluting waterways with toxic heavy metals, and turning fertile farmland barren. Some Jamaicans who live near the mines have grown ill, while those who could move away have simply left their home villages. Yet rather than requiring mining companies to pay us back for their pollution, the Jamaican government is actually subsidizing them. Jamaica recently waived $10 million in taxes on a private mining company, Windalco. Finance Minister Nigel Clark claimed that helping Windalco would save jobs. Sure, a few mining jobs, maybe. But this is a company that, through its land grabs and pollution, has disrupted the economic earnings and viability of farmers, fishers, and countless others for decades. Why is it only mining jobs that deserve government support? What about the rest of us, whose farmlands, livelihoods, health, and futures are being destroyed? Then it's time for the last word, our feature article. Headline this week, Rewilding Nature. Maverick conservationists in Europe are trying to restore missing species without waiting for approval from bureaucrats, said Isabel Cockrell in Coza's Coda story. Will beaver bombing succeed? It was 1998. Olivier Rubers, then 29 years old, came up with the idea of returning beavers to his local rivers. My level of knowledge about nature was extremely poor, he now confesses, but he read a magazine article about how the beaver was indigenous to Belgium, though it had long been nearly extinct. Bringing beavers back, he thought, would be a great project. Beaver bombing, or beaver black ops, as it's become known in conservation circles, is the practice of illegally releasing the humble beaver into a waterway and leaving it to do what it does best, fell trees, build dams, and construct lodges. Beavers are known as ecosystem engineers, or a keystone species, because they create an ideal habitat for all kinds of other wildlife. Rubbers borrowed his father's car and drove to Germany to pick up the beavers, then crossed the border back into Belgium and dropped them in a river. Throughout 1999 and 2000, Rubbers repeated the feat with 97 more beavers, bringing them from Bavaria to Belgium in a van kitted out with homemade beaver crates. We wanted them all, he said. Rubbers and his accomplices soon learned that the best time to beaver bomb was not at night, but in the middle of the afternoon, preferably on a Sunday, when everyone was having lunch. He procured almost all the beavers from Gerhard Schwab, a wildlife manager based in Bavaria, known as the Pablo Escobar of beavers. Over the years, Schwab had bred beavers and helped numerous communities across Europe with reintroductions, always in partnership with local wildlife management schemes. Rubbers showed Schwab some official-looking papers, all stamped and in French. Schwab had no idea that Rubbers was introducing the beavers into their new surroundings without local approval. "I had all the authorizations I needed," Rubbers said, which, in my mind, meant no authorization. Rubbers was eventually fined €500 for detaining and transporting a protected species, although he told me that the local administration forgot to claim the money. He has spent the following years watching with satisfaction as the beavers spread across Belgium, transforming its waterways. Frogs and fish came to lay their spawn in the slowed, dammed up water, while bugs and beetles thrived in the rotting wood of the felled trees. Birds followed in their wake, feeding off the fish and insects. "Belgium should thank me for services rendered to the nation," Rubbers said. Rubbers is part of a secretive underground network of wildlife enthusiasts who are returning species back into the landscape without asking permission first. It's not just beavers. There are boar bombers, a butterfly brigade that breeds and releases rare species of butterflies, and a clandestine group returning the pine marten, one of Britain's rarest mammals, to British forest. At the beginning of the 20th century, beavers were on the verge of extinction in Europe. They were hunted for their prized pelts and scent glands, and by 1900 there were just 1,200 left. Now beavers are back from the brink, with the current European population estimated at about 1.5 million. And conservationists and rewilders agree that beaver bombers are partly to thank. The healthy wetland systems beavers create can sequester large amounts of carbon, according to climate scientists. Slowing down river flow helps the land act like a sponge, storing and holding more water, so it is more resilient to flooding and drought. Beavers work for free. They work weekends. They work around the clock, increasing the groundwater and being a motor for biodiversity, Schwab said. In the U.S., after Oregon's devastating forest fires in 2021, beaver wetlands remained green and lush, acting as natural firebreaks. On aerial images of the charred landscape, the beaver's habitat stands out, a wide and verdant ribbon running through the blackened trees. "I think beaver bombers are the heroes of our time," said Ben Goldsmith, a British financier, writer, and environmentalist who is a passionate supporter of rewilding. "A human lifetime is short. Why should I not be the one that gets to see wildcats back on Dartmoor? Why should I not live in a country with beavers when they're supposed to be there?" For ecologist and author Alex Morse, by contrast, the fringe of the rewilding movement and its powerful backers are a problem. "Who cleans up the bill for illegal, anonymous, rogue rewilding if things go wrong?" she wrote to me in an email. "Maverick rewilding," she said, "could increase the chances of conflicts between humans and wildlife, spread disease, and actively harm biodiversity by introducing the wrong animals into the wrong environments. There are also releasers who are skirting around the law or outright breaking it," Morse added, "or making decisions based on personal bias rather than ecological expertise, rather than lawful, professional, and evidence-based conservation done carefully and less glamorously." Morse said she welcomes true rewilding, but is concerned that the movement is being co-opted by a privileged few who want to turn nature's last refuges into eco-Disneyland. As rewilding and the prospect of nature restoring itself has caught the public imagination in recent years, projects have sprung up all over Europe, often led by philanthropists and enthusiastically backed by politicians. But many of these projects have also become entangled in bureaucracy and an intense debate over the specific practicality of rewilding. Goldsmith is vocal about what he sees as a reactionary fifth column in the conservation movement. There are these gray figures that lurk in the background of government agencies and other bodies who kill off these projects before they have a chance to happen, he said. These are people who are governed by caution and say, we've got to make sure every possible angle is researched to death. They don't feel the urgency. Derek Gao told me that he believes change will never come if the rules are always followed. Gao, 58, worked for a decade as a sheep farmer in Devon in southern England, but is now one of the loudest voices in the Maverick rewilding movement. He had his moment of reckoning when a pair of curlews, a European wading bird species, disappeared from his farm. They died, Gao says, because there was nowhere left for them to take cover, feed, or breed. How solemn and how sad that is, he said. They died because we had mowed everything to a bowling green with the sheep. After the birds were gone, Gao began to see his farm work as a model for perfect destruction. He observed the men alongside him who had worked in agriculture all their lives. They can remember the last of the gray partridge or the glowworms, and even though they've done nothing for nature, they've done nothing other than continue their destruction. When their time finishes, that's the thing they'll remember. Gao now runs a 300-acre rewilding project in Devon with financial support from Goldsmith, among others. He spends his day among wildcats, Iron Age pigs, wild horses, beavers, and storks. He wakes up every morning to a cacophony of birds singing from the trees. And he thinks the time has passed for doing things slowly and carefully. I do wonder how the people who administer these things, who display the most incredible caution and naivety and a lack of willingness to do anything, really feel when they finish a long, long career and have achieved absolutely F all. Gao recently gifted former Prime Minister Boris Johnson a beaver pelt. Johnson has been vocal and enthusiastic about rewilding. We're going to rewild parts of the country and consecrate a total of 30% to nature, he said in 2021 to rousing applause during his speech at the Conservative Party conference. Beavers that have not been seen on some river since Tudor times, massacred for their pelts, are now back. And if that isn't conservatism, my friends, I don't know what is. Build back beaver, he added. Johnson tried to give his father, Stanley, a pair of beavers for his Somerset farm, but was reportedly thwarted by his own government's regulations. Meanwhile, rewilding has become a popular activity among Britain's landed elite. King Charles III has a wildlife retreat in Transylvania, a rewilding mecca known as Europe's Yellowstone. Goldsmith jokingly described an emerging black market for wildlife trade unfolding in the gentlemen's clubs of Mayfair. You've literally got conversations happening over the lunch tables of whites where one landowner is passing beavers to another, he said. You know, I've got beavers on my farm in Perthshire, old buddy, old pal. I could bring a few to you in Herefordshire. This is a sticking point for Morse. It is healthy that a class of elite, unelected people are using their wealth and privilege and influence to make changes to places, rather than with places and their communities of plebes who live and work there and don't get a say, she said. It feels like a form of eco-colonialism. In Scotland, a cohort of millionaires, billionaires, and corporations known as the Green Lairds have brought up huge swaths of the highlands for rewilding and carbon offsetting nature restoration programs. It is not democratic or always particularly wise when restoration rewilding is led by unqualified rich lobbyists. Oh, excuse me, hobbyists, said Morse. With his bandana and grizzled white beard, Gerard Schwab stands out among the dark-suited crowd of business travelers at the Munich Airport arrivals gate. We drive straight out into the Bavarian countryside. When I was a child, there were a lot more edges between the fields, he says. As we drive past huge featureless pasture land, the neat green crops rippling in the early summer sunshine. Now it's just effing green. But then you had everything, all kind of wild plants. All the small ditches, all the small creeks, they're all gone. He takes me to a rare scrap of wilderness, the pocket of a meadow right next to a busy autobahn, has been transformed into a vibrant wetland. Bright blue dragonflies dip across the water, and the air seems to vibrate with birdsong. Schwab points to something in the distance, and I can see a pile of sticks, a beaver lodge. We hear the two-note call of a cuckoo. I'd never heard it before, though it was familiar sound for my mother, who grew up in Surrey in the 1960s. Europe has lost 550 million birds since she was a child, and in Britain, cuckoo numbers have crashed by 70%. The cuckoo's distinctive call is a traditional symbol of the start of summer, but most children in the UK will grow up never hearing it. The strange sorrow we feel when we confront this world without our fellow creatures has a name, species loneliness. Isolated from nature, we feel an existential loss of how the world once looked and sounded. For Ben Goldsmith, his despair over the destruction of our wild places intersects with his own grief over the sudden loss of his teenage daughter, Iris. A lifelong lover of nature, she died at age 15 in a farm vehicle accident in 2019. He has since given his farm over to rewilding. The spot where Iris died is marked with a stone circle. Not far off, along the stream threading through his land, a family of beavers has appeared. The family on my land happened to make their own way there, which is sort of a beautiful irony, Goldsmith said. They appeared by magic at a time in my life when I really needed and wanted that. It was one of the happiest events of my life. Beavers are resilient creatures. When the Kadova Dam collapsed in Ukraine in May, it unleashed a torrent of chemicals and toxic oil into the surrounding landscape, with untold amounts of debris flowing into the Black Sea. But amid the waterlogged wreckage of Kherson, a lone beaver was seen wandering the streets. "Okay, I've got work to do," one British tabloid quipped in a caption of the video. Beavers are used to rebuilding, restoring, and fixing what's been broken. Schwab feels sure beavers will long outlive us. After all, they have roamed the earth far longer than humans. The oldest fossil is about 30 million years old. "When my bones and your bones are gone," he says, "the beaver will still be here." A version of this article was first published by Coda Story, CODASTORY.com. We'll pick up a couple of the health and science pieces today. First is the Gulf Stream about to stop flowing? A critical system of ocean currents that transfers heat around the planet could collapse as soon as 2025. Effectively an aquatic conveyor belt, the Atlantic Meridional overturning circulation, which includes the Gulf Stream, transports warm water from the tropics to the North Atlantic and sends back colder water along the ocean floor. But the compounding effects of climate change, including an influx of cold water from melting Arctic ice and the loss of Amazon rainforest trees that put water into the atmosphere, have upset the system's balance and could alter the current flow. Until now, scientists believe such a catastrophe was a long way off, reports the New York Times. But a new University of Copenhagen study based on sea surface temperatures dating back to 1870, suggests that the system is already critically unstable and could stall out any time between now and the 2090s. That could have massive consequences, sending North American and European temperatures plunging, further heating the tropics and disrupting the monsoon rains that billions of people depend on for food in Asia, Africa, and South America. Not all scientists agree that the data indicate such a dire timeline, but it is very plausible that we've fallen off a cliff already and don't know it, says marine scientist Hallie Kilbourn, who wasn't involved in the study. By the time any of this science is settled, it's way too late to act. How to quit biting your nails. If you can't stop biting your nails or picking at your hair or skin, help may be at hand, reports NBC.com. In a new study, researchers found that an approach called habit replacement can potentially help people curb these obsessive compulsive behaviors. The technique is simple. Whenever you feel the urge to scratch or bite, and even at times when you don't, to train yourself to the new habit. Gently rub your fingertips, palm, or arm. The rule is just to touch your body lightly, says study author Stefan Moritz from University Medical Center Hamburg-Eppendorf in Hamburg, Germany. If you're under stress, you might perform the movements faster, but not with more self-applied pressure. The approach was tested on 268 people who said they habitually bit their nails or the inside of their cheek or plucked out hair when stressed. After 6 weeks, over half said they experienced improvement, compared with 20% of a control group. With further research, the technique could prove a boon to some 20 to 30% of Americans who bite their nails. And we'll move on to the talking points page. Start with the article, GOP Trump Alternatives. If not DeSantis, then who? Donald Trump is now under three criminal indictments and is likely to be indicted again in Georgia in coming weeks for his attempts to overturn the results of the 2020 election. But with the Iowa caucuses 6 months off, said Shane Goldmacher in the New York Times, Trump's support among Republican voters remains stunningly strong. A new Times Siena College poll shows him crushing his nearest challenger, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, by 54% to 17%, while no other candidate topped 3%. Trump leads commandingly across almost every demographic group and region. In theory, there is an exceptionally narrow path for a non-Trump candidate, said Nate Kahn, also in the Times. 37% of respondents said they could be persuaded to back another candidate, and 25% are dead set against Trump, meaning 62% are up for grabs. But with the stiff, unlikable DeSantis fading and his campaign in disarray, nobody seems positioned to steal a nomination Trump looks all but certain to win. As desperate never-Trump Republicans cast about for a savior, some eyes are on Tim Scott, said Ed Kilgore in New York Magazine. The South Carolina senator has a credible resume and strong favorability ratings, and is a fundraising dynamo who's built a substantial war chest. His optimistic bent, overt religiosity, and inspiring personal tale of overcoming poverty are connecting with voters, with polls in Iowa and New Hampshire showing him in third place and rising. Sorry, Scott doesn't stand a chance, said Jonathan V. Last in the Bulwark. A genial, single black man, his sunny disposition is out of step with the combative Republican electorate. If he surpasses DeSantis in the polls and actually poses a threat to the orange God King, Trump will chew him up and spit him out in short order. Then there's Nikki Haley, said David M. Drucker in the Dispatch. Some wealthy GOP donors are making a bid to position the former South Carolina governor as the consensus alternative. She's a seasoned chief executive who served as Trump's U.N. ambassador and has good command of both foreign and domestic policy. But she's polling in the low single digits, and the donors indicate their patience is limited. Meanwhile, Vivek Ramaswamy has started to catch some momentum, said Caroline Vakil in The Hill. The 37-year-old biotech entrepreneur is being lauded as an effective communicator with an impressive professional resume. Rising poll numbers suggest voters are starting to give a serious look at Ramaswamy, who's trying to out-Trump Trump with an extreme anti-woke platform that includes disbanding the FBI, cutting executive branch workers by 75%, and raising the voting age to 25. But no GOP strategists really believe he can win. Most believe he's positioning himself for a Senate run or a cabinet position. Ramaswamy is playing the same losing game as DeSantis, said Alex Shepard in The New Republic. They're promising GOP voters Trumpism without Trump, combative culture war politics executed efficiently and without chaos. But that requires praising the policies of the rival you're trying to topple. And besides, GOP voters like Trump's chaos and recklessness because it torments the libs. They have no interest in a knockoff version when the genuine article is sitting right there. To make matters worse, said Rich Lowry in National Review, the Trump alternative's fear of Trump and MAGA voters is palpable. They avoid criticizing or even naming him, evading questions about his transgressions, or reverting to carefully crafted non-answers. It extends Trump's polling dominance to a kind of personal and psychological dominance. They are afraid, and he's not. No Republican can possibly win that way. Some GOP never-Trumpers are hoping for someone like Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin to step up and save the day, said Tim Miller in The Bulwark, but they're living in a fantasy world. In the Times poll, 71% of Republicans say they don't believe Trump has committed any federal crimes, and 71% insist that Republicans need to stand behind Trump. So a candidate like Youngkin, who would have to win over voters who see Trump as blameless and his alleged crimes as attacks on their tribe by the deep state and the elites. As one respondent, David Green of New Hampshire, put it, he might say mean things and make all the men cry because all the men are wearing your wife's underpants and you can't be a man anymore. But at the end of the day, you want results. Good luck getting a voter with that worldview to wake up one morning and switch his vote to a candidate being pushed by the globalist Wall Street Journal Republicans. UFOs, a deep state cover-up? David Grush wants you to know that all those stories you've read on the internet are true, said Seth Shostak in MSNBC.com. During a House hearing last week on unidentified aerial phenomena, UFOs to ordinary earthlings, the former military intelligence officer testified that the government has staged a multi-decade extraterrestrial cover-up. Among Grush's accusations, that officials have recovered non-human biological matter from alien crash sites, that the Pentagon is reverse engineering alien technologies, and that these mysterious visitors might originate in higher dimensional space. Grush even hinted that witnesses have been murdered. Such extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Yet Grush, who once claimed the Vatican was in on the conspiracy, admitted he has never seen any alien wreckage. He explained, speaking to the facts told to him by anonymous insiders. Several House Republicans lapped it up anyway, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. Representative Tim Burchett, Republican from Tennessee, treated Grush with total credulity and pledged to uncover the cover-up. Maybe Burchett really does believe in little green men, or perhaps he wants to use Grush's alien assertions as more evidence that the deep state U.S. government can never be trusted. Blame for UFO mania is bipartisan, said Timothy Noah in The New Republic. It was a Democrat, the late Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, who pushed for a program to study mysterious airborne objects. And the two previous UFO hearings were held while Democrats controlled Congress. All this fuels a feedback loop. The media pushes UFO stories for online clicks, and politicians fear they'll be branded elitist for dismissing the crackpots. UFOs deserve investigation, said Jeffrey Kluger in Time. U.S. military pilots have reported more than 650 instances of flying objects moving in ways that defy conventional aeronautical physics, such as making sudden turns at hypersonic speeds. If foreign drones are behind these sightings, that would be a national security threat. There may be other explanations, glitches with imaging systems or optical illusions. And aliens, our nearest neighboring star is 24 trillion miles away, so aliens would need an astonishing degree of technological achievement to zip here. Maybe that happened. Maybe the government kept those visits a near-perfect secret, but that's a lot of maybes. Science tends to prefer simple answers because they're the ones that are usually correct. And we've time for a couple of quotes. First up from George Orwell, "The quickest way of ending a war is to lose it." And Lily Tomlin says, "If you read a lot of books, you are considered well-read. But if you watch a lot of TV, you're not considered well-viewed." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.